Pastor Jeff, thank you very much. And what a beautiful message of being redeemed. There's nothing like truly having the sense of the eternal God who has bought me. And that's the grace that we're talking about. And it causes us to respond in some way. And it cost him something very dear. And it cost us, does it not? Yes, it's free. He says, come. Now respond. Thank you. What a beautiful, beautiful song. Well done. I want to begin, and I want to say very clearly, I want to make sure that I'm clear on this point. I can come to the place in my Christian walk where I can say, I honestly love God. And I can say, especially after meeting you, I love you. I do. And I love your heart. I love your soul. I love who you are and what God has done in you, your life now, and what his goals and plans are for you. And with that, I feel that there is a responsibility to preach a sermon that might be a little bit hard. It may come out a little bit difficult. It may come across challenging. But for your life and for the life of people who could be affected by your life, for the greater kingdom of God, there's times we need to challenge each other. So I hope you hear my heart and that I do this simply out of love. It's such a topic like this. I have been challenged by these verses I'm going to read tonight for many years. And of course, my call into ministry, it becomes part of it. But in the last 6 to 9 months, really this has challenged me. And so what I'm preaching at any time, I think a preacher offers to their people anything, know that there's a whole lot of hours that we spend quietly in a room being challenged by the words that we want to offer. And so the words I think tonight are challenging. Just know that. It really, I think, launches us into the coming days, and the coming days become almost illustrations for such a topic as this. And I think this morning it becomes somewhat of an illustration of the text here. It's a hard text. The disciples said it was hard. And we, so many years later, realize it's hard. If you have your Bibles and if you'd like to follow along, and I'm going to make reference to it, I'm going to be looking at the Gospel of Mark tonight. Mark chapter 8, beginning with verse 27, and we're going to just bleed into chapter 9, verse 1 as a way to kind of have a beginning and end point. And again, I'm reading from the English Standard Version. And Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. And on the way, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And they told him, "John the Baptist. And others say Elijah. And others, one of the prophets." And he asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered him, "You are the Christ." And he strictly charged them to tell no one about him. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. And he said this plainly. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and seeing the disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan! For you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." And he called to him the crowd with his disciples and said to them, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his life? And what can a man give in return for his life? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels." And he said to them, "Truly I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God after it has come with power." My wife and I mentioned my children. I am not going to start every sermon with my children's stories, but I'm going to tonight. My wife and I mentioned earlier today when we were in Bible college and we met, we talked about our future family and we looked forward to it. And I said something this morning, I think I was just meant to be a father. I love being a dad. I absolutely enjoy it. So much so that Jan and I, we talked about it, so we started having children, Ronnie first, and they would begin to talk and have those cute little things that they say, and Jan would document what they said, and she would date it, and she continued to do that with Ronnie, then Nathaniel came along, and then Eli and Maddie, and she continued to document those things, but as they get a little bit older, some of those things, you know, we have less of Ronnie and then less of Nathaniel, but that third son, Eli. Elijah Wesley Adkins, we call him Eli, that one is different. That one is a philosopher. I think I can say this to you. I have often said that Eli, now Maddie, we're kind of recording her and those kind of things, but Eli's 11 years old and we're still documenting things. He says he's a philosopher. He really is. Eli is some kind of a mix between Cy Robertson from Duck Dynasty, Yogi Berra, and if you watch commercials, TV, that adult beverage for the world's most interesting man, he's some kind of weird mix of that an 11-year-old. We continue to document things that he says, and I would like to share with you some of the things he says because Eli has the right definition when he talks, but he tends to use the wrong word that goes with it. And through the years, we've documented, and I had to limit my list here that I would like to share with you, but just so you get a feel for what I'm saying here. He has the right definition, but he has the wrong word. Eli once said this, my jaws got in the way of my tooth, which is to say, I bit my cheek. That's philosophical. We were eating supper one evening. He grabs his head and yells, brain hot, brain hot. I have a brain hot. And we're looking, and then we realize, we're eating soup. Who has a brain hot? I thought you have a brain freeze from ice cream. He gets a brain hot. I don't even know what that is. I've never had that. Yeah, it hurts. He came home from school one time. And from one of the years, and I would begin to ask questions. I said, ask him about his teacher. He said, my teacher is a whole bunch of teachers. I said, what? What he meant to say is she teaches a lot of subjects. So she's a whole lot of teachers. Eli, we let him go with a friend, and they were playing in the woods and those kind of things, and had the dog, and he was all excited when he came home. He loved his friend's dog, and he wanted to tell me about his friend's dog, and he described it this way. He said, Brett has a dog, and he's a half of a whole bunch of things. And one of those things is the wolf. I said, how about that? I did not realize that about Brett's dog. One time I'm looking for one of my older kids in the middle school locker room or something, and we're going in with Eli. I'm like, Eli, come here. And we go into the school, and I said, get in there, go in the locker room and find it. And I'm waiting. I'm like, you know, what's going on? Eli came out, and he's holding his chest. And he comes out to me, and I thought, oh, no, what happened to Eli? He said, I lost myself in the locker room, which is to say he couldn't find his way out. He lost himself in the locker room. That's the way he talks. Another time we're having a conversation, and we love to do this at the end of the day. We're sitting around a supper table, and we're talking about the day and about school. And my oldest, Ronnie, was talking about English class, and he said, we learned about idioms today. And I thought, well, that's great. And then here's my chance as a dad. I love to teach anyhow, and I think, we share things, and so the younger ones can hear what the older ones are learning and vice versa. And I said, okay, Ronnie, what is an idiom? And before he could answer, Eli has the answer. He said, I know. It's an idiot who's a him. Right definition, wrong word. He does it. He'll ask me the strangest questions out of nowhere. I'm not even expecting it. He came up to me out of nowhere, and it threw me for a loop because my mind was on other things, probably church stuff or whatever, and he came up to me and he said, hey, Dad, is a female butler a buttless? I don't think so. And he leaves. That's the kind of stuff I get. if he catches you or myself talking to yourself while you're working or doing something, he makes reference to, they're thinking outside of their head. Yeah, thinking outside of your head when you talk to yourself. One time, this is a phrase he uses. Like if you let's say you hate Brussels sprouts, you have something you want to say, I really hate this or I do not like this. He does not use the word least favorite. His phrase is, and we've tried to correct him and he knows it, but he still uses his my favorite worst. My favorite worst vegetable is Brussels sprouts. My favorite worst. That's the way he talks. If you're okay, let me just share two more, okay? Because this one, I thought about this today, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to go ahead and share this. I coach a lot of baseball, and we've done well, and from an early age, I teach all my teams, or we do a lot of signals, and hand motions, signals, and those kind of things, and several of my teams, depending on the kid, I can show them where I want them to hit, I've taught my kids are switch hitters, and Eli's a switch hitter as well. And I gave him the sign. I wanted him to bat left-handed, and he got into the batter's box and right-handed. And I am trying to say, so I'm trying to give a signal, and I can see a shift and those kind of things. And I want him to move around. I'm watching what's going on defensively, and so I finally call time and I step aside and I just say it from third base. I said, Eli, I said, don't you want to go left-handed against this pitcher? And he responds out loud to me in front of everyone, no, he's all over the place, and I hit better all over the place right-handed. You should have seen that poor little kid when he looked at, he's all over the place. That's how he is. And one other thing, and it's a phrase Eli uses, he says, you cannot pull my leg. I mean, if you're joking, you cannot pull my leg. You can yank on it, but you can't pull it. All right. So, and I have so many more. The point being, my son Eli, the little philosopher, he always seems to have the right definition because we'll correct the word that he uses and he'll say, yeah, I know, and then he'll use the word that he uses. He has the right definition, he uses the wrong word. In the text, though, that we just read, we come across Peter and the other disciples who have the right word but the wrong definition. You see, it's the opposite of my Eli, who has the right definition and the wrong word. Peter seems to have the right word, but he has the wrong definition. And that seems to be the core of what is happening here. And if you're following along, I would like to begin with verses 27 to 30 and say right there, within that little section, those little verses there, we find a wrong definition. A wrong definition. As the story begins to open up, Jesus is walking with his disciples and he's in an area that is called Caesarea Philippi. Caesarea Philippi is in the furthest northern area that Jesus ever was. This is the furthest place from Jerusalem, ironically, that he ever was, and he begins to ask his disciples, who do people say that I am? This is significant. Caesarea Philippi was built by Herod the Great. You've heard that name. And he made a temple there to the demon, to the god Pan. And later on, his son Philip remodeled it, and they dedicated it to Caesar Augustus. You know that name from Luke's Gospel, chapter 2. And here Jesus is in this very pagan area in Mark's Gospel, the furthest point from Jerusalem he has ever recorded as far as being. And he asked the question, this is ironic, who do people say that I am at this furthest point? And if I were to use Luke's Gospel, and if I were to use chapter 9, verse 51, I would use the phrase, he turns his face towards Jerusalem. Because everything that happens in Mark's Gospel comes to a climax right here in the verses that we read. From this point, everything else changes. Jesus has been doing beautiful miracles, and they're finding out, who is this person? And from here on out, they see why he has come. It all changes. This becomes a hinging point for the rest of the Gospel. And they answer him. They say, they give three names, do they not? Some say John the Baptist. Some say Elijah. Some say the other prophets. You have these three answers. It's quite interesting with these three answers. They are all equally wrong. The world is wrong in their understanding of Jesus. He has been ministering all the way to this point, and it's all wrong. Yes, they have the right definition. They have the right term. They have the wrong definition. Unlike my son, who's the opposite. He always seems to have the wrong word. He asked a question, then follow up. And he's asking it to you and I today. But who do you say that I am? You and I have to answer this question, because whatever comes out of our life, whatever comes out of our behavior, answers the question who we really believe that Jesus is. The way that we communicate with others, the way we treat our spouse, the way we treat our children, the way we treat our coworkers. If we're a business owner or a foreman, the way I treat my employees says, it gives an answer to who I believe Jesus is. This question has been echoed down through the centuries, and you and I have to answer that question. And we will answer that question, maybe not verbally. We will answer that with our life and how we relate to God and how we relate to one another is the answer to who we believe. You see, it's in the second person plural. Real good definition of that is you all. Who do you all say that I am? He's asking about the world. But who do you all say that I am? They give the world's answer. It's a wrong answer. And then Peter says, you are the Christ. Christos in Greek. Messiah in Hebrew. That's a powerful word. And Jesus recognizes that it's a powerful word. And Jesus doesn't even confirm it. He doesn't deny it. Why? Why did he do this? Peter had the right term. He had the wrong definition. You see, culturally, the understanding of who the Messiah was going to be. And he, by the way, he says, do you remember? This is confusing as well. He says, don't tell anybody. Are you him or not? And he said, don't tell anybody. Does that ever bother you, by the way? You're studying through Mark's gospel and like, why is Jesus saying that? Why doesn't he want us to proclaim who he is? Doesn't he want us to tell other people? I don't think they're ready. I don't think they're quite ready. They don't have a deep understanding of who he is. They have the right term. They can assign to him Messiah. You are the one that's promised throughout all the Old Testament. And they don't know what it means, because in their mindset, it is a nationalistic, military, political leaders who the Messiah would be. He would be a deliverer, a liberator of these foreign people, these Romans, these pagans who have polluted our land, and they saw that he would come and he would cleanse them by the land of taking them out, whoever this Messiah would be. And Jesus is saying, you don't have the right definition. This is not who the Messiah is. This is not who I am. They don't get it. They've got the right term. Messiah is correct. The definition is wrong. I can't help but think about that beautiful passage in John's Gospel, chapter 20. And, you know, we've just come off of Easter just a month ago. And there in chapter 20, we get the first day of the week. And I can't get into all the detail of that. But there's so much symbolism. You and I are meant to read John's Gospel different than we read the other Gospels. We are meant to see the deeper understanding of symbolism and light and darkness and those kind of things. And so when we begin to read chapter 20, we are told it's night, but it's morning. Dawn is about to shine. Mary is the one who goes to the grave, and she sees, while it's still dark, the stone is rolled away. She's scared. She doesn't understand. Misunderstanding and darkness go hand in hand throughout John's gospel. She runs off and gets the other disciples, and she brings them back. We know those are Peter and John, and they come, they look, they do not understand. At one point, John says he believed, but he didn't understand. Oh, it's dark, but dawn is about to shine. They leave and go away. That's when Mary engages or is engaged by two angels. Then there's a so-called gardener. And she turns around and she has a dialogue with this gardener who is not the gardener. And you know what's beautiful about this? Is all he says, when I should ask you, at what point does she recognize who Jesus is? Do you remember from that story? All he says is Mary. By the way, a little footnote here, I believe that John chapter 20 is a fulfillment of John chapter 10. When there Jesus says, my sheep know my voice, and I know them. All he speaks is their name, her name. Is that not powerful? But her response is, Jesus, and she turns him Rabbi, or Rabboni actually is what she says. And he says, do not cling to me. Why? Why would he say that? I believe that response is exactly what's going on here in Mark's gospel. Do not cling to me. I think it's for two reasons. One, I think it's him saying to her, Mary, do not get it in your mind that everything is back as it once was. And to be consistent with John's gospel, his hour had come. He's fulfilling. It's transforming the world right before her eyes. The world will never be the same. Don't get it in your mind that things are back as they used to be. Things are changing now. And secondly, he had not yet been glorified. You see, she had the right term, the wrong definition, and he helped her through that. Peter is the same way. He is told to keep the secret. And the reason he's told to keep the secret is he had the right term. He does not yet understand it. The rest of this gospel, from this point on throughout the rest of the gospel of Mark, is to show him what discipleship looks like. I hope you get that. I hope you get that. Because how often do we in the church have all the right Christian words, say all the right Christian things, nobody questions us, and really we have no idea what we're talking about? And could it absolutely skew the life and the spiritual life of another person? I hope not. I hope not. Secondly, a new description. We went from wrong definition to a new description. Verses 31 to 33. Look at these again. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. And he said this plainly. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said to him, get behind me, Satan. For you are not saying your things on the mind of God, but on the things of God, but on the things of man. Have you ever had one of those really awkward conversations where afterwards you think, I don't think we were talking about the same thing? Goofy old me, I have many times. And those awkward conversations can be a result of many things. It could be a result of an assumption. I'm assuming that you understand and we understand each other and you feel the awkwardness. It could be you highly regard the person you're speaking with and it becomes a little clumsy and you feel like, oh my word, I'm making this worse and it's awkward and I'm not sure that we're even talking about the same thing. It could be all kinds of things. Maybe you're trying to impress the person. But it seems as though when you look at this dialogue of poor old Peter and Jesus, it's as though it is as awkward as it gets. Peter isn't trying to do anything wrong, but he's operating from the only definition that he knows. Because he has the wrong definition of who the Messiah is. Notice this, that when Jesus answers him, he said, but who do people say that I am? And Peter answers the Christ, and he charges them to say nothing. He then gives a lesson on the Messiah, Christ. No, he doesn't. Jesus changes the term. Did you see this? Verse 31. He gives them a lesson on the Son of Man. Now, is he denying that he's the Messiah? Not at all. The definition that would connect the Son of Man will help them understand who the Messiah really is. This is absolutely significant. You notice this, how Jesus does this. He's saying, in essence, you do not have the right definition. You have the wrong definition, actually. And it's the right term. But let me tell you about the Son of Man. He gives a lesson on what is called the Son of Man. This is a different term. And the Son of Man had a historical understanding of being both something of humility and something of divinity. And isn't it interesting that the Messiah is now going to talk about that, this twofold understanding? And we could go to Psalm chapter 8 and we could see a very human-like son of man term and the definition. And then we could go to Psalm 80 and see something very divine-like in this term son of man. We could go to Daniel chapter 7 and we definitely are getting something that is divine-like. And here, Jesus, at the furthest point of Jerusalem, is turning his face towards Jerusalem to show them what true discipleship looks like. And he gives them a lesson on the son of man that is very human-like and yet is divine. This is absolutely beautiful. And in this small little dialogue, and as Jesus teaches them, here in verse 31, he speaks of the Son of Man in a way that is very humble, of being rejected and suffering. But by verse 38, he uses the term in a different way, as though he is the judge of the world. All in one little short lesson, which should help them use that definition and apply it to the term they're using, Messiah. To help them understand these things. Then we have this phrase, verse 31, and he began to teach them on the Son of Man, and this word is super important, must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. Must. In the original language, it's two words. We could literally translate it, it is necessary. The Son of God, pulling his disciples aside and saying it is necessary, reveals to you and I something very important, because he's asking the essence of who he is. Who do people say that I am? Don't tell them the term you're using. Don't tell other people that. Let me give you a lesson that you can apply. And by the way, it is necessary to suffer. And not just suffer. The next word in the Greek is powerful, but here in English is powerful. Much. It's a divine necessity. This must occur. This is absolutely important. If you're going to be my follower, you have to understand this. If you're going to define who I am, you must. It is necessary. You understand. I must suffer. Boy, there's a happy time. I remember I was asked to do a seminar at a pastor's conference years ago in Dayton, Ohio, for the Evangelical Church, and I was working through some things, and I couldn't help it, but I came up with this topic as I was, again, searching through some things, and it was suffering as mutual sharing. Because I was a pastor, I was dealing with so many things that people were dealing with, working them through. How do I keep my faith? How do I have this sweet life that Jesus calls us to in my suffering? It didn't go over very well. That's not a fun topic, suffering. Let's talk about the good stuff. Let's talk about the blessing. Jesus isn't doing that. At the climax of the Gospel of Mark, he's talking about suffering, and it's a divine necessity. This must happen, and much of it must happen. The suffering, rejected, killed, and rise again. And this is Jesus saying, now that you said who I am, let me tell you why I came. I can't get my mind around this at times. I've been a Christian since I was 7 years old. I've been in the church morning and night. And I still, at times, I can't get my mind around this. And you know, I don't think that I'll ever want to. Nothing can make me more angry than watching someone suffer. Death is the enemy of life. It should anger you. And yet, we have a Christ who has suffered much. And if that's not enough, the gut punch to you and I, and what many people will turn and walk away from Christianity, is he says, follow me. Are you kidding me? That's not easy. That's hard. That's hard. This is the first time of three instances he begins to prophesy that he's going to suffer. We go to the next chapter in verse 31, 9:31, he's going to say it again. We go to the next chapter in chapter 10, verses 33 and 34, he's going to say it again. He must suffer much. And then Peter's had all he can handle. And you know what? I would do the same thing. Jesus, come here. I'm going to do this respectfully. Come over here. I got to talk to you. And he rebukes him. Why did Peter feel like he needed to rebuke him at that moment? Why did he need to pull him aside? He's trying to be respectful. He's not trying to do anything wrong, but he's trying to set Jesus straight. This is not what I signed up for. Get over here. Let me talk to you, Jesus, because you got it all wrong. What is wrong with you? You're being negative. Jesus' definition of Messiah, or now the Son of Man, does not match Peter's understanding. You know why? Because in Peter's life, what Peter wanted to do, if we use the words of this text, he wanted to save his life, he wanted worldly gain, he wanted worldly profit, and he was ashamed of Jesus. This one that Jesus, the way Jesus is defining himself now, he's ashamed of that Jesus, and he's ashamed of that gospel. And how many of us have been there as well? We don't want to be rejected, do we? We want to tell the gospel to somebody else, but we don't want them to turn away from us. We don't want to suffer. I don't want to suffer. Jesus then turns and rebukes Peter. Poor Peter. It's not enough that he rebukes him. He calls him Satan. Wow. Jesus, can you go a little softer on the guy? I mean, can you use another term? Satan, really? Does that bother you? It kind of bothers me. Satan. He calls him Satan. Are you the arch enemy of God? But that's the point. Is it not? Peter's standing in the way of God's plan of salvation here. Through the suffering and the dying on the cross. It's because it is Satan's plan to disrupt the plan of salvation. A true disciple takes up his cross and gets in line behind Jesus and follows him. And Satan gets in the way and tries to stop that plan. He doesn't want Jesus to suffer because that is going to be the redemption Pastor Jeff sang about. He doesn't want that. And I think Dr. David Smith at Indiana Wesleyan University is right when he says this. Any understanding of the Messiah that does not include suffering, pain and the cross is satanic. Get that around your mind. Any kind of discipleship, whatever discipleship is, if it does not include suffering, if it does not include picking up a cross and carrying it, it is satanic. It is not of God. And that's the place where many people will walk away and say, you know, that's enough. You guys are radical. Jesus, you're radical. And he talks about a separation in verse 33. The things of God and the things of man. He says that you're either going to follow me or you're going to follow the world. And this phrase, get behind me, I would associate it with the phrase in verse 27. Where there we are told in almost a figurative speech in a way, literally they're on their way to Caesarea Philippi, and figuratively, they are on their way as Jesus is leading them towards true discipleship. Get behind me. They're on their way. This is what it looks like. Who do people say that I am? Now let me show you. I will tell you, and now I'm going to show you through the rest of this gospel of what it looks like. You know what? I think I've come to the place in my life as I've viewed Peter and I view this story. I think this is Peter's sin. I think I'm at the place where I can say Peter's sin in this passage is idolatry. I think that's where I'm at. Because Peter was trying to mold Jesus into his image, rather than allowing Jesus to transform Peter into Jesus' image. I think his sin is idolatry. And I got to ask myself, am I doing that? Do I want to soften the gospel and begin to create Jesus into my image, what I want him to be? This frustrates me as a pastor when I deal with people who always want to soften the language. I deal with even some pastors who have tried to soften the language. And I say, you're creating God in your image. That's not the Jesus I find here in the gospels. I find it to say, take up your cross and follow me. we're going to Jerusalem. And what happens in Jerusalem? He's raised up. And he dies for many. He gives his life as a ransom for many. Thirdly and finally, way of discipleship. Verses 34 to 9:1, I think he shows from here on out, this is what discipleship looks like. Notice this. Old Peter grabs him and takes him off to the side and says, Jesus, we got to talk. And he rebukes him. And Jesus turns and sees the disciples and rebukes Peter in front of them to draw them in. Then we are told, then Jesus, seeing the crowds beyond that, he has a message for the world. Whatever he says here is for the world. And I'm reminded of William Lane, and he said, self-renunciation and cross-bearing is for everyone, not just church leaders, but everyone who confesses Jesus as the Messiah. There are so many churches, and this might not be one of them, but I had to go into PBRC meetings where I deal with a church who proclaim that the pastor or the church leader must suffer much like Jesus, and they don't. But they want the pastor to. And Jesus is turning to the crowd and saying, this is for everyone. This is an announcement to the world. This is not simply for the church leader. This is for everyone. It's for the world. Self-renunciation, taking up your cross. And by the way, simply acknowledging Jesus as the Messiah is not enough in the Gospels. No, not at all. Jesus demands participation. He wants your participation and mine. He wants us to engage him. And I can't help but think of that beautiful passage in Romans. I love Romans chapter 8. But there in verses 16 and 17, we read this. The Spirit himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. At that point, we should be aghast. Oh, I'm a child of God. And if. So it's contingency clause. It's contingent on something. And if children, then heirs. Wow. I'm not sure if anyone has ever been an heir to an estate before. What does it mean to be an heir? We're called to be an heir with Jesus Christ. But he goes on. Heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ. Catch this and do not miss it. Provided we suffer with him, in order that we may be glorified with him. Whew. Yeah, it's hard to say amen to that, isn't it? Provided we suffer with him, it's costly grace. He's not just dumping this on everybody, and you can claim grace every time there's something wrong in our lives. He's saying, provided we suffer, we are heirs, provided we suffer. Oh my. I was reading through Revelations a couple years ago, and I try to yearly read through the Bible, and I'm going through the Revelation, and as I'm reading through it, I'm seeing over and over again this word for to continue to the end, this call to continue. Don't give up. We come finally to this threefold cost of discipleship. Deny self, himself, take up his cross and follow me. It's difficult. If anyone would come after me, again, that same idea, get in line. Get behind me, Satan. He's on his way. If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. Deny himself. What does it mean to deny myself? Biblically, to refuse to be guided by one's own interests. I've got a lot of interest, but I must refuse that to take up God. I must lay down my life because he laid down his life for me. I'm reminded by a story by Henry Nouwen from The Wounded Healer. He retells a story from his missionary journeys in India. And he tells this strange story, almost mythical, if you will, of these four brothers. And these four brothers were wanting to find a new art, a mystical art. And so they ran off to learn their art, their science of something. And they came back together after some time. And the first brother said, I have mastered a new art. If I find a bone of any animal, I can recreate the flesh that goes on that bone. And the second one said, oh my, if you can create the flesh on that bone, I have learned the art of creating the skin and the hair or the fur that goes with that bone. And the third one said, if you can do that, I can take that skin and that fur, and I can begin to create the limbs that go with that bone and the body. And the fourth one said, if you can do that, I can give that beast its breath. Well, these four brothers were absolutely excited by their new art, their new science, and they ran off into the jungle to find a bone. And as fate would have it, they found a bone. It was a bone of a lion. And the first brother took up the bone and did his art that he had learned and created the flesh and went to that bone. And the next one began to create the skin and the fur. And the third one created the limbs and the body. And the fourth one gave it its life. And this lion rose from the ground and shook its mane and leapt upon the boys and killed them and went off into the jungle. And Nathan Castens has said this, and we too have the capacity to create what can devour us. Goals and dreams can consume us. Possessions and property can turn and destroy us. Where are you? Because what I have found in the Church of Jesus Christ across America is that many people hear these words, they know these words, and they want to compromise with God. They want to make a deal. I will do this if you will do this for me. As long as I don't have to suffer. As long as this doesn't happen or that doesn't happen. I'm willing, God, as long as I can get a little of this and a little of that. Can I have a little bit of comfort? And I can't help but think how many people are not reached and never will hear the gospel because we are sitting here compromising with God. Or maybe a sin has so captured our hearts and we begin to justify it. You know, our coworkers and friends can really help us justify sin. It's okay. Everyone's doing it. It's okay. God's grace covers you. God's grace is costly. And that thing will consume us. And there are people, maybe either in this community or somewhere in this world, who may never hear the gospel of Jesus Christ because we are driven by our own self-interest. Secondly, take up your cross. By the way, this word, as I study Mark's gospel, is only used one more time. Here in chapter 8 and then in chapter 15. You know what happens in chapter 15, don't you? Everything else in between that, I believe Jesus shows what discipleship looks like. And it goes to the cross. Folks, that's hard. Especially for those who are standing there listening as the cross demonstrated something nasty. It was associated with Rome and those pagans. Their cruel shaming of criminals and a society that was led by honor and shame. It shamed them to the utmost. And Jesus is calling us to this. This is absolutely offensive. I was teaching at a university. It was originally a Bible college. It became a university while I was there. And it did it quickly, not slowly. The administration that came in to do this is now gone. And that administration did some things that made me absolutely sick to my stomach and led me away. And thank God into the ministry again, over and over in my life. We don't submit our life. Let me just say this theologically. We do not submit our life once to God and then justify everything else that happens in our life. It has to be a daily submission to God. It must be. I must be submitting because my will get in the way every time. Give me a couple days not submitting my will to God and I'll begin doing my own self-interest. I got to tell you that. And then we justify we're okay. That's a whole nother sermon. I was sitting in the balcony on a chapel. The president of this fresh new university, Christian university that was very recently a Bible college, stood there. It still had so many ministry students. It gave a sermon illustration that it would be that to be successful meant big and much. Not much suffering. Much is in material things. In his illustration, he said, it would be better for you to be a manager at Bob Evans Restaurant than to take a small church. I was sick to my stomach. Bible theology professor, sitting in the balcony, I vividly remember, I think I gasped out loud. And these young, skulls full of mush, if you listen to Rush Limbaugh, ate it up. They ate it up. Why would I go after this? Why would I sacrifice myself? Why do I need a cross? I can serve Jesus in other ways. Oh yeah, I can be a manager of a restaurant. I can do this. And I will give God my tithe. Well, God demands that. And I watched the sweeping away. And I couldn't help but wonder, all these young men and women were headed somewhere in ministry, and those who did not go, and the folks who may never hear the gospel. Oh, because one man in one instance said, you need to synthesize the world and the gospel, and they ate it up. Follow me, he says. Jesus, who seems to be in constant motion in Mark's gospel, I challenge you to read chapter 1 of Mark's gospel and underline the adverb immediately every time you see it. He's in constant motion. He's moving all the time. Jesus is on the run, it seems. And he calls his disciples here to get in line. Get behind me. Fall in line, Peter. You're acting like Satan. You are being Satan by stopping the salvation of the world because I must suffer, and I must suffer much. So you better get out of my way if you're going to be my disciple and get in line. And you, by the way, take up your cross and deny yourself. Deny yourself from all your self-interest. Deny yourself from all of the dreams and plans that you have. Give me your life and let me do something beautiful. And by the way, Wednesday night when we're together, we'll conclude with Peter, a beautiful story. I can't help but ask, are you willing to lose your life for Jesus and the gospel? Because that's what we're called to in verse 35. You know what that means? That means something hard, being ashamed. Being shamed on earth by others around us. Not securing our life so that I can gain Christ. The gospel, by the way, I challenge you to look up the word gospel in Mark's gospel. The word gospel. Every time you see it, except for verse 1 of chapter 1, which is an introduction, which I think we could say it would answer my point here, it's always surrounded by persecution. The word gospel is, every time in Mark's gospel. Where are you? Church. Church. There has to be a model church. Elizabeth City EMC, there must be a model church. Somebody's got to get this. Because if not, it's going to cause our whole nation to turn upside down, to capsize. If some church does not take this model of discipleship and move forward, you could be the ones that could save our nation. I know that sounds big and huge. By denying yourself, by showing us what it looks like. We have to have a church who will do this. But we continue to justify our sin. Look, let me conclude this way. And Pastor Jeff is going to come. Pastor Sean's going to come here in just a moment. Costly grace. It's costly because, and to use the words of Bonhoeffer, it calls us to follow. It's grace because it's following Jesus. It's costly because it cost a man his life. It's grace because it gives a man true life, you and I. It's costly because it condemns sin. It's grace because it justifies the sinner. And it's costly because it costs God the life of his son. It's grace because we see within God the Father, he did not consider it too big of a price for you and me to offer his son. Oh, I hope you see that. I don't know if you need a time of prayer or if you need to, like, I need to run out of here. This guy's crazy. Or maybe there's somebody who or you are so burdened for in your family or a coworker a neighbor, and you think, I know that God could do something in their life. How do I reach them? And you know what? That's the costly part of grace, by you speaking to them. And maybe you just need a moment of prayer tonight for that person. Maybe someone, the Lord is laying somebody heavily on your heart. Maybe there's a young person here being called to ministry. That's costly. But it's faith of what God can do in their life. Maybe the Lord's moving on you on a new ministry of some kind. Maybe you've been challenged by Pastor Sean or Pastor Aaron on the ministry. Maybe, I don't know, you've been with them and you've seen something. You say, I'm lacking something. And this could be the very thing. Maybe I have not completely given all myself to God. And maybe you'll say, I need to hear some more. Circumstances of life may keep you from tomorrow night. I don't know. I have been impressed by your spirituality. I've been impressed by the prayers. I've been impressed by the leadership. And so I actually, in many ways, I look up to you. What a dear church. But I know there's things in your heart. You're burdened for others. I hope you are, because the church should be. That's the yoke of Jesus Christ. And so we're concluding now. Pastor Sean, please come. Pastor Jeff. And I'm just asking that you would seek your heart and say, Lord, is there anything else that I need to offer up to you in my life? Please come, Pastor Sean.